I disrupted relationships. I became very selfish. You know, you'd have plans the next day, but that won't happen now because you've decided that you want to get another bag in at 4 a.m. I love the person that I've turned into now. Like, I've got that life that I wanted, I suppose, when I was drinking, but I wasn't ready to sort of like activate it at that time. Yeah. And yeah, I just feel like I've not completed it, but like I'm on my way to like getting it, if that makes sense.
Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scolfort, and to our new season. We are going to undress and reveal what it is actually like behind the cameras as we cast a spotlight on fashion. In this episode, I welcome Matt Busbridge, the head of men's division at Premier Model Agency, who spent the past 15 years working in one of the world's most glamorous industries. Matt opens up about the life he built, the pressures that came with it, and the moment he realised something had to change. Now more than 3 years sober, Matt reflects on how giving up drugs and alcohol transformed far more than just his social life. Speaking a lot about social pressures of the fashion industry, we also cover the importance of honest conversation around sobriety and that dreaded moment in the early hours of the morning when you realise the party is over. Matt, welcome to This Is Powerful. Thank you for coming on here, mate. I know you're busy being the head of men's division at Premier. You must be super busy, so I appreciate your time.
No worries, mate.
I'd love to talk to you about the industry, but in this podcast, we go back to the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd like to know about you, the audience. Like, where are you from and how was your upbringing?
So I'm from Kent originally. My upbringing was... I don't know, like I always say, like I was very cotton walled by my mum. Like I'm a very like mummy's boy. And as time went on, that kind of changed. My sister had kids very early. She was 16 when she had her first child. And as a kid, as a 13-year-old boy, I kind of felt that that really like pushed my nose out. I felt like I wasn't being seen. And I felt like that for a long time. And obviously the more children she had, the more pushed out I felt. So I suppose it was a very difficult balance for my parents to find that. And I felt that their love or their support was predominantly via sort of financial. It was like, here's some cash, here's some cash. And, you know, I felt that that was very much something that maybe affected me in the long run when it also came to like my drinking. Because it was kind of like, instead of like helping to resolve the situation, it felt like it was very much like, you'll be all right, here's 60 quid, you'll be okay. Like, and it was, and that's kind of, I think was a bit of a snowball effect, with that sort of like problem occurring. But yeah, apart from that, my childhood was great. Like I just very loving parents, still together now. So I've got a very strong system there. I was very much into my sports. I was quite a big boy when I was younger.
Would you?
Yeah.
To be honest, when you walked through the door, I thought he's got some shoulders on him. Like he looked like strong. Yeah. I thought on camera, I thought he looked really teeny.
No, it's. But yeah, I used to play rugby when I was younger. I was pretty fat kid. That always works. But funny enough, the more weight I lost, the further down the line of the scrum I went. So it was like I ended up at the back row. But yeah, I loved sports. I was very sort of like academic, enjoyed my school, had a good group of friends, and then obviously stayed on to sixth form, which was, you know, great. It kind of felt as if you started becoming a man when you went into sixth form. Yeah. And like you sort of started going out and drinking when I was 17. And it was just fun. It was like this new thing that I'd never felt before because I was very... anti-booze when I was a kid, and my dad was like, that'll change when you get older. And
why was you anti-booze? Because I really was
I just didn't like the taste of it, and I just didn't like the idea of it. Like obviously my dad would have we'd have like friends over, like barbecues and stuff, and you know the family would have a few drinks and like get all like silly and dancing, and so it was never a concept of my dad or my mum was like a heavy drinker, so that's why I detested it. I just didn't like the taste of it, but yeah, obviously that developed over time, and kind of just found myself. I found this new like lease of life, and you know, like growing my hair out and like wearing my skinny jeans and through all that indie period, and felt very individual, which I loved. I really enjoyed that idea of that. And
where was you before then? Because when you find something, usually before you're kind of stuck in a structure and there's no excitement. It might be nice, but there's no kind of excitement. And then when you find a freedom, is that what happened? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just the idea of drinking and like taking drugs when I was like 16. it scared me. I think one of the main reasons it scared me is because my auntie died. She was a heroin addict. So she died in her 40s. So that was always a bit of a, like, I wasn't close to her, but it was a, like an indication to me to be like, look, stay clear of that shit, because otherwise you're going to get sick, you're going to get addicted, and you're going to die. So yeah, it was always very much sort of playing with that idea. But I think when I got to being 17, I think being able to go into, like, there was like an indie club that we used to go to where they'd, like, under 18s would go in there. You weren't allowed to, but it was just, I don't know, that excitement of like this, it was like a new chapter. And I think that's why then everything just fell into place. Like the idea of going drinking with your friends and then going to this club and just looking forward to that Friday night when you knew he was going to do it, because you'd go out and buy like a new outfit and you'd make sure it was like your plumage, like a peacock.
It's like a celebration, isn't it? And
exactly, mate. And it was just a good time. It was very fond memories. And like, you know, even on one of them old school, I still got Facebook and I get these memories pop up, and it's just like, you know, obviously my bonnet's down there and I've got copious amounts of hairspray in it to keep it there and like my skinny jeans. But it was just a fun time, because I think you're amongst other peers that are also entering that stage. Yeah. And I think that's why you're all in it together.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a case of like one person like myself was like, I've just found Booze Boys and I'm really enjoying it. Do you fancy coming from? They're like, no, we was all in it together. And it was like a movement in itself. So yeah, I think that was kind of like obviously the first phase of my drinking when that happened.
Which is a nice introduction. It is a nice phase in life, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Because you are mature and you're going out finding your people.
Exactly.
So you went to uni after?
Yeah, so I had a bit of a up and down with uni, because I went to Portsmouth University to do media. And my girlfriend at the time came and saw me 2 weeks of being there. I was like, I miss you so much. I want to come home. And then like, I sort of came back from Portsmouth, went back to my parents, and then went to Canterbury University, did journalism, because I used to do a lot of writing. I used to write for fashion magazines.
Did you? Where did that come from? So if you was like, you sound like you're quite a lad with your rugby and drinking and stuff early on. How did that side come in?
I think I've always been interested in clothing. I've always been, even at a young age, I always wanted something that was a bit different. Like I was the lad that in year six, I would have the Holland bright orange jersey and all the other kids would have an England. Do you know what I mean? I always liked stuff that sort of stuck out a bit. And I think as I got older, obviously your taste changed. Like I went from wearing like baby blue tracksuits with like baby blue hat and my Air Force Ones. And I went down to the Lacoste Avenue with the polos and Ted Baker when it was a thing. And then it sort of just started developing. I think I've always been quite experimental with what I wear. And I've always, like the weird thing with me is I don't always like the attention, but like I do things to get the attention. That makes sense. It like does, getting tattoos on my neck and on my hands. And I've got like swearing on them, some of them. And it's, so you kind of know that it's going to have a bit of a reaction with things. But yeah, I kind of feel that my progression with fashion, it was just a case of like, I just enjoyed it. I enjoyed looking different. I enjoyed buying stuff and looking at things. And, you know, before we had all like the search engines now, like it was very much you'd have to go deep diving into things and find these obscure websites. And the whole writing came about, I just, because I did a little bit of like modeling when I was younger, like when I had longer hair. It was like my early 20s, I think.
Who's that for?
I was with this, like, I can't remember their bloody name. They were based in Epsom. It was like one of those sort of ones where they would ring me up pissed up at night time and be like, you've just got a casting for Vivian Westwood coming up. And it was all bollocks. Or they'd be like, Burberry are interested. And it was like nothing. Yeah. So yeah, I think with like the modeling side of things, I started like talking to like photographers, and then one of them used to write, I think it was called Supplementaire Magazine. And I used to do like written pieces. Like he'd send me a brand or a designer, and then he'd be like, I need you to write up a 500 word thing about this designer and blah blah blah. So it was that was where my taste for like the journalism side of things came about. And then the Canterbury University thing, it was very much like radio journalism, and I just wasn't feeling it. I think it was just wrong for me to dive into another subject straight away. So took a year out. And then I went to a local university called Rochester UCA, University of Creative Arts, because I got friendly with all the first years, because they'd go out to the same pubs and clubs that I used to go to. And they would talk about their course. And I was like, that sounds amazing. I really want to get on that. Mm. So yeah, they got me in there, spoke to the tutor, rolled me on to the next semester. And then, yeah, did that for 3 years, which was great. Really enjoyed it, because the practical side of things was amazing. Like, creating a magazine or doing a photo shoot or a lookbook or a brand. And yeah, it was just fun. I love the aspect of creativity. And then came out of uni, came out of a third, didn't do too well because with the projects, you have to do a critical analysis. And it's basically how you got to that stage of creating that shoot. Mm. But like, I didn't really think of that. I just one day it'd be like, oh, I might do a shoot. Like I did like a James Dean inspired shoot in like a car scrapyard because he died in a car accident, didn't it, in a scrapyard. Yeah. Like it was just like stuff like that, but I didn't research into it. So it was when I had to start doing the critical analysis, it would bring my marks down because they were like, well, you've done shit. Like, it doesn't
I find that really weird as well because it's, if you're creative, you don't really do that. You just have inspirational ideas, don't you? Come up with
it. Of course
you
do.
I think it's because they want to nick the way it comes along.
Yeah, probably. But it was just annoying because I was like, I've really put a lot of like work into getting to that point. But came out of there, had like sort of an outlook on the fashion industry that wasn't positive. I didn't really want to work in it after doing it. But then I saw a job going on, do you know Fashion Monitor? So it's like a website, sometimes they have jobs going. I'm just going back in the day now when it was like, used to do stuff like that. And there was a job going as a junior booker at Elite London. So yeah, I just applied for that. They called me in, had an interview, and then had to go back for like a training day. So I had to like sit there and like, I remember this guy called Marco who was on the image department was like, Matt, you need to start picking up the phone a lot more. Like, just keep picking it up and pretending that you're on the phone. And I was like, okay, so I was like doing this and like sort of saying.
What was your first impression of that? Because people have a whole idea about what the model industry is and what an agency is and what it looks like. And I know when I started, it used to be like the stock exchange, like people screaming on the phones, fucking numbers flying around everywhere. Will you do this? Can you do that? Negotiating really hard. Mm. And when I go into an agency now, it's like, silent, just tapping. What was your experience like?
Just mad. It was just crazy. Like you said, the phones would be ringing, there'd be people shouting, there would be half naked people walking around the agency getting Polaroids taken.
And that's like a young lad as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's just me at the table. So put your clothes back on, Matt. Answer the phone. But it was just that it was like a circus, you know, crazy. But I don't know, when I first started at Elite, it just felt you had more creative input into things. Like you'd literally get a boys' book because I work on the men's.
Why did you want to work with men? Because it's unusual for a straight guy to work with men.
Yeah.
I'm generalising.
But I just, one, it was the only job that was going. And two, I just feel like men's, there's far less politics.
Yeah.
The women's, every day there's a fucking problem. Every day they've got an issue with New York or they've got an issue with Paris. So they've got, whereas my team, we've got like a good hub of agencies that we work well with. Boys, there's less demanding, like I'll be honest. And also because I think you're not working with like hundreds of thousands of pounds on rates.
Yeah.
So like there's one interesting fact, and what's great is women get paid far more than what the men do. It
used to be about 2/3.
Yeah, I think don't know it's what it is a now. Lot less than that probably now.
Really?
Yeah. You know, really? Even there could be like a campaign for like, and the woman would get 200 grand, the guy could get like 15 grand. Do you know what I mean?
It's, wow, it's crazy.
Yeah, so I felt comfortable. I liked menswear. It seemed to fit a lot better with like my, you know, how I work and what I was interested in really.
Yeah.
I wasn't interested in women's, but as time's gone on now, like I do wish I would have done women's because there's far more money in it and there's better salaries in it as well. So it just fit. And I just ended up being there for like a good 7-8 years. And then I worked at Storm. So I headed up the men's division there.
Did you?
Yep. And then I got let go because it was COVID. So I got let go. It was like, you know, last one in, first one out kind of.
Yeah.
And then I ended up working at a small agency called Unsigned. During COVID, I don't know, we obviously talk about my drinking and stuff, but COVID was really tough. Like I think that was the worst of my drinking and my drug taking. Like it was unreal.
How old was you then?
Christ, when was COVID? Like 2021?
6 years ago.
So I was like 30.
Yeah.
It was just a really difficult time. And I think like obviously when I lost my job at Storm, it knocked me for six as well because I was like, fuck, we're going to try and find a job now when there's nothing going. Like obviously we had that furlough money coming in, so you had a guarantee amount of money, a salary coming in to pay like rent and stuff like that. But yeah, fortunately enough, there's these guys, Cesar and Gavin, who own Unsigned, and I've been friends with them for a long time, and they're basically like They're an agent.
Of course I know. I'm sorry. Yeah.
So just explain to people as well, like they're like an agency that used to scout models and then place them with agencies. And they also have like celebrities and like Helena Christensen and stuff like that.
Yeah, he's a good egg, Gavin. I like him.
He's great. Really lovely bloke. And they basically create a job for me. They created a job. They created a model agency job for me where I headed that up. And they basically pulled all their models from the agencies and just had them all in-house. So I was good. I was there for like a year. But I missed that going up to London. I missed being in that office space. It's like a bit of a drug. Like you miss that chaos. And
it's a community as well, isn't it?
It is.
Energy and adrenaline.
Yeah, and I love that. I love going to work. I love experiencing that. I love like the noise, music blaring up, people shouting, like people, random people coming into the office who are like walk-ins, and like you have random fucking clients coming in, and it's just, I just love that hustle and bustle of it. And at Unsigned, they didn't have an office space. So everyone was working on Teams or like on Zoom, and I just missed it. And then I got a phone call from, I think it was like Stevie Wild, the recruitment guy who does a lot of the job hunting within the industry. And he said that there's a job going at Premier. Like, and at first I was like, Cara White, like, fuck that. I was just like, I can't work with Cara White. I've heard all these, like, do you know, you hear all these stories of people. I've never met the woman, but like you just hear all these stories from other agents and people that have worked there. And I was like, I can't. But then at the same time, I was like, let's just meet her, let's see what happens. So anyway, he set up this interview, but I hadn't heard nothing back from them. So I'm around the corner near their office because like, I'm just like waiting for him to give me a time to go around there. And I'm like 4 beers in because I'm like, well, obviously it's not going to happen there. I might as well just get the drinks in. So I'm like a bit like, you know, a bit pissed. Yeah. Next thing I get a phone call and he's just like, yeah, Carol's waiting there for you. I was like, fuck off. Is she actually? He's like, yeah, you're late. I was like, already that's going to be bad. And God knows what she's going to be like. I smashed the interview, done so well with that. And then I got called back for another interview with them. And then, they gave me the job. So I've been there for like 5 years now.
What questions do they ask for an interview for a model agent?
I think it's just a case of they're more interested in what, like, obviously what clientele you work with. You know, if you've got a good in with like the Spanish industry, or you work with H&M, well, that's what people want to know. They want to know how much money you're going to bring in, or what talent you're going to like snatch from your agencies and bring them over.
Yeah, I was going to say a different word then.
But yeah, it's mainly that. But I think it's more just to get an understanding about like who you are and like how you present yourself and like your character.
Yeah.
And that's why Carol does 3 interviews, because she's like, you can't get an idea of someone's personality with one. It was a case of just like going back and forth. But they just want someone who's going to gel well with a team. He's not going to be a knobhead. But also, you've got a bit about you. Like, you can't have someone like, you know, like who's static and like quiet and like shaky. And like, do you know what I mean? You need someone who's got a bit of bollocks, and they can, maybe they're a bit cocky, maybe they are a bit arrogant, but like it works.
Well, you need personalities.
You do.
Otherwise, you just get ironed out or left in the corner.
Of course you do. When you imagine a client and you're trying to discuss rates with someone, and they're like, well, we're not doing it. And you're like, okay, no worries. We'll just do it for that amount. Do you know what I mean?
I've seen that as well.
Yeah, of course. But you have a mix. Do you know what I mean? Like, we've got people in our office, the people that like are happy just to get in there and get their job done, and that's fair enough. Do you know what I mean? They've got some people who really want to push. So it works. It all gels. It all works in motion.
From uni days into work, how did your drink change? And did you think at one point, fucking hell, I'm using this as a crutch, or it's not fun anymore, it's become something different?
Yeah, I mean, at uni, it was very much because there was always stuff going on, like there'd always be an event going on, or like, you know, taking a trip up to London, or so everything was a bit new at the time. So I didn't really see it as much of an issue. I think the only issue I had at that time was, for some reason, like I'm a huge binge drinker. I'm the same when I eat. I was the same when I used to smoke cigarettes. Like everything was always have to be done like quick, done, quick, next one. So I would drink like 4 beers within like an hour, just like necking them down and down and down. And I think that was a bit of an eye-opener when I was at uni. Is like, you know, I remember times when I'd go and sit on my own in the uni like bar. And I was meant to be going to a lesson, but I'd be like 3 beers in because I've drunk them so quickly. Like it just hits you. And I'm like, fuck, I can't go to a lesson like this. I feel pissed. And it is, I don't know. It was just messy. Like it's just very sort of like, I feel like in the early 20s, it's just like messy drunk because you don't know your limitations. You're working it out. You're working out what drinks work well with you, what you like, what sends you over, what doesn't. Like, you know, I know people that are like, can't drink brown liquids, like whiskeys, because it fucking makes them angry and aggressive. And so, yeah, I kind of feel that when I then started working, I suppose because I was commuting every day, like the drinking wasn't as bad because I was just like, I had to get home, I had to drive my car. Like it kind of like, I was very sort of like just started my job. I wanted to give a good impression. But when it came to like the weekends, obviously it would be like a blowout. Like I'd love, my weekends were like all about a big blowout or a Friday night. And then I'd ruin the whole of my fucking weekend and that'd be me done. Do you know what I mean? In bed. But I think it's like, do you know when like, you start going away on work trips and stuff like that. Like I'd treat them like a holiday. Like it was like I'd have drug dealers' numbers in Milan, drug dealers' numbers in Paris. Like it was like I knew who to surround myself with and who would like want to have a good time. And just like always pushing things to the limit, missing flights, like because I'd been out the night before. And I think I started to get a bit clumsy with my drinking. But it was all very much like after work drinks. Like we used to have a thing called Monday Club, where we would just go and get absolutely rat-assed on a Monday, like for no apparent reason, but it was just a case of just doing that. And then that would fuck your whole week up.
At my agency, it was Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
Yeah, exactly. But like, I think there was just more of like a drinking culture. I think, obviously since COVID, I think things have changed. Like you don't have those Friday drinks anymore, like because hardly any agencies are open on a fucking Friday now because everyone works from home. No one wants to go out. No one wants to sort of like even go for one after work. Everyone's like, just wants to, like you said, wants to get home.
I think COVID affected people in a way which they still don't realise.
Yeah.
With that.
Yeah.
Because even myself, I love to socialise and still go out for dinners and stuff. But at a certain time, like, I just want to be home.
Yeah.
And before, I have kids, obviously, so I do for those reasons. But it was just going out and out and out and out and out.
Mm.
And even at my agency, I went in the other day and like I said, phones are so quiet, people are just emailing. And one of the agents said, I wanted to get tickets for this concert. I was like, why don't you phone so-and-so?
Mm.
And they're like, it doesn't work like that anymore. Yeah. What do you mean? Like, because when I started, even up to 10 years ago, everyone was connected in film, industry, music, and you could just make a phone call, get tickets, or go to a premiere.
Yeah.
And that's completely dropped off.
Yeah.
Very weird.
It's weird and it's quite upsetting. It's like even the industry in itself, like I said to you on the phone the other day, like with rates and like menswear stuff. And it's just like, it's really become very like dog eat dog now. Yeah. Like people like taking jobs from people not offering certain boys or girls to agencies because of what happened back then. And it's become very sort of like very toxic.
It's like everyone's pulled their cards in, isn't it?
Of course. No one wants to share. No one wants to help. Like you're in it on your own. And it's quite a, like, not a lonely existence, but it's just like, it just feels as if people are just there just to get the job done and then go home at the end of the day. Yeah. There's not that, like you said, like, everyone is on emails now, or WhatsApp, or, like, you're messaging boys on fucking Instagram Messenger. And I think even for the young generation, like, the young lads and the young girls that are coming through, I think sometimes, like, they don't even know how to talk to you. Like, they're so used to just being on their phones and doing things virtually. I think it's made it so tough for them to, like, be able to, like, socialize and do things. And it's tough. Like, you have boys come into casting sometimes and they like, some of them like are very good and they've made friends and stuff, but some of them just won't even talk to you. Like, they won't even talk to each other. They'll just sit there. And it's sad. It's sad to see it, because even clients, trying to get a client to go out for lunch, it's so difficult now.
That's weird, because clients and agencies used to like always free lunch. Like, do you think, I remember in, gosh, years ago, 94, in Milan, all of the big fashion houses was like, we're only paying in T-shirts and like bags. So they said to everyone, we're only going to give you like an Armani T-shirt or Versace or whatever. So the agencies, it was the first time I've seen it happen, all stopped. What they all phoned each other and said, we'll have a meeting. They all met and they said, no, we need to get paid this amount. We need this amount of commission. And they stuck with it and they broke that rule.
Yeah.
And they literally was going to stop Fashion Week.
Bloody hell.
So maybe there's something there where everyone needs to get together.
Yeah. And I mean, they've been doing it recently with like I said, the AI introduction. So, because obviously that's going to affect a lot if it comes through like it has been, and certain clients take it on board, and just that loss of money, do you know what I mean? And also the loss of the creative arts, really, because like you think of a call sheet, get rid of 95% of all them, yeah. and that's all you need. Do you know what I mean? But yeah, it kind of feels that there's so many agencies now, and it's so oversaturated. I think since COVID, everyone became a scout because everyone was scouting online.
Yeah.
And then everyone wanted to create an agency. Yeah. And I just think there's so many people now in the market that there's always going to be someone that says yes to something.
That's the problem. I mean, to be honest, when I started, I don't know men's rates now, what they get. Right, if you was doing, like, when Topshop was there, for example, I'd get 8,000 for half a day, four shots only.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was good money.
Mm.
And same for whoever. Sometimes shows, you get paid 10 grand to go to Milan to do a show.
Mm.
But you'd only be eight pitches a day. Everyone would be done by X amount of time. You knew what you was doing. Mm. There was about 30 people on each shoot.
Yeah.
With an assistant of an assistant and all that stuff.
I feel like you'd be so lucky to get anything like that now. I think even for some clients, I feel like they really push their luck, especially during shows. I fucking hate shows. I don't do them. I don't get involved with them. Like, fortunate enough, like my team, they do.
Yeah.
But I think it's just wrong. I think it's wrong the fact that there's young boys and young girls going to these castings, waiting 3 to 4 hours in the sun. Like, especially in Paris last week when I was out there, it's 42 degrees. And you're getting a 17, 18 year old boy to wait. And then you're asking him to come back to do a fitting, waiting around another 4 hours, and it's getting to like midnight.
Yeah, probably not giving him any food or water.
And you're not paying him.
Yeah.
They're not getting paid for that. They're not getting paid for the fucking 5 fits confirms that you keep doing, and then all of a sudden you don't want him. And also the fact that, sorry, I'm on a vent.
Let's get it out, Matt.
But it's what all these people that, like, they put options on boys like months in advance for like an exclusive. And so the boy can't do anything else until they've made a fucking decision.
Mm.
And then they start doing it last minute, saying, oh, we don't want him now. Mm. And it's, so they've lost all that work to do other things because of your fucking greed.
So it used to be where you used to get paid £25 to go to a casting when I first started. And they couldn't hold an exclusive until you actually signed up.
Mm.
So that's really changed.
Yeah, you've got people asking for exclusives for shows like back in October for something that's in like January or later on in the year. That's
the problem though. People are just, I think it's just frivolous. Like, oh, we can do this, we can do that. Everything's disposable.
It is.
Needs to be a standard.
The funny thing is, mate, like, these big fashion houses pay far less than what these high street brands do.
Yeah.
You make more money doing like a H&M e-com day than you will doing, like, I'm not going to say brand names, but doing an exclusive with one of them. It's crazy, but I don't know. Like, I just, and also, when I was doing my sobriety stuff, like when I started the podcast, I really wanted to work more with, I wanted to create like a company for the models that's like more of like counseling. Because I think there is like the well-being thing that goes on. But I think for boys, like, I don't really hear anything like in terms of like any events or anything for the guys or even stuff for like the girls. Mm. In terms of like having like a client that agencies hire, or they pay like a monthly subscription where you have like a counselor, you have like someone that can come in and like teach you about like how to deal with rejection, or like, you know, when your charts are quiet, or like, you know, because when you're 18 you see all your mates doing stuff.
We should do that together, because I've done it on the quiet for quite some time.
Yeah.
Because I used to I hate saying when I was a big model and working, people always come up and say, oh, how'd you do this and how'd you do that? And I'd always take a half hour with a coffee and sit down and explain all about rejection, what it really means, what effort you should put in, where you shouldn't put effort in, how the whole system works. And I think just having that education alone is invaluable.
Of course.
Because you do, I mean, for me, you know, I started off drinking and using because it was to belong.
Mm.
And I'm quite a quiet person naturally.
Yeah.
So to go in and be all this crazy stuff, which I completely do as well, it was like hard, especially when there's people who've got big personalities.
Yeah.
And I weren't sure how to handle it. But then it became a complete coping thing.
Mm-mm.
So like what you're saying, if you're a young man and you're doing like the shows and you've got to wait for 4, 5, 6 hours to deal with stuff, what are you going to do?
Mm. Yeah, but I think also, like I said to you before, like, you guys, it's a very lonely job as a model. Like, even for us when we're booking jobs for you guys, you I don't know, some of us do have a fucking heart. Like, I'd say my team, we're very, like, we're huge realists. Like, we're not, like, we don't sit there promising the world to people. Like, I've never done that. And as like a team, like, I never do that with new boys that we take on, whether it's like older guys that we take on. Like, the worst question for someone to ask me as a model is to go, so what kind of clients do you see me working with? Like, it doesn't work like that. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, it's all swings and roundabouts. And at the same time...
But that's valuable of you to say that.
Yeah. But I'm just being a realist, because I'm like, things change, can change overnight. The clients that I can see you with now might not want you in like a month's time. And I'm just going to promise you that we're going to work as hard as we can to get you as far as we can. Do you know what I mean? But I just feel that some agents will sit there and promise people the world and be like, I can see you doing this campaign and you're going to do this and do that. And it's like, I kind of feel like it's very sort of like American to be like that. It's very like, we're going to get you this.
I've heard that a lot, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just like, it's bollocks, because I wouldn't want that pressure first on myself, but also on you if it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
But I just feel that we are, I'm, you know, bigging up my team here, because we are really fucking good at what we do. But the talks that my team have with these young boys and these mums and dads that come in, you know, we always say that education is always the priority in anything. Like, we are now starting to like learn over the last few years that you can't launch boys like when they're 16, 17. Like, we wait now till they're 18 so they can literally do everything. Obviously, there's some shows that they can do when they're like under 18, but there is no point showing a boy to like clients when they're 16, 17, and they can't do anything, because I know full well that if the client can't get the time on that boy, they'll get bored of that boy, and then that boy's no good anymore when they are ready to model. It's so much like that now, mate. Like, clients want new guys every week. They want a new boy, another new boy. And it's just like, you don't have that time to then develop someone. Because as soon as you launch them out, and they might do one good thing, and then that's it. And then that's why I'm coming with the counselling thing. Like, then how can you help that young lad who's just done a major show, but now hasn't done anything for like 6 months?
Might be the best route is to get counselling for the clients.
Yeah.
Because there's so much addiction mentality in here.
Yeah.
It's literally, we've got to have a change. We've got to do stuff. Yeah. Because I really think it's really interesting, because I noticed over the years, I was very loyal to clients, and I was lucky because I had clients for quite some time. Consistently, but you'd hear it as well, like, I need a change. But it's not actually that they need a change. The person needs something exciting for them. So it really comes down to the individual as well.
Yeah.
If you've got someone who's really cool and calm and knows what they need, knows their brand and knows what they want, they'll have that for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, obviously there's a lot of clients that are very loyal, and they will use the same boy, they were using for campaigns, they were using for lookbooks, they were using for e-com. But then you get some people that will literally, especially it's during show seasons. And these, you know, obviously men's doesn't have a show season for London anymore. That's completely gone. So to have a platform to launch these boys has become so much more difficult now. And I think because of the use of social media, guys and girls are now more observant as to what goes on in our industry and like where you could get to and what you could have. And I think that really plays a lot on their minds when they're sitting there indoors, but yet their mate's shooting this, that, and the other, and your model accommodation, when you're sharing a room with someone who's like got like 10 castings for shows and you've got one. Do you know what I mean? Then you've got to sit in that flat on your own, and then where does your mind go? Do you know what I mean?
And I mean, I've had that experience when I shared like in Milan for the first time, like four people in a place, and someone's doing campaigns, some weren't, and et cetera.
It's a lot, and I just, you know, I wish we could have the time to do that as agents, but you don't. Like, it's like even now me doing this podcast, I know when I come off, there's going to be a shitload of emails to get back to. Like, it's just, you just don't have that time, and you want, and for something like that, you need to be fully invested into it. You can't just be half-hearted and like, oh, let's have a meeting once a month, or let's, do you know what I mean? It's, but I definitely feel that there's something definitely missing with that criteria.
You could do a biannual thing.
Yeah,
we invite all the boys in and say, this is what we want to talk about, this is what we want to explain to you, this is how things work and how they change and etc. You could have like a big talk, literally for either multiple agencies or for your own guys.
Yeah.
Hi, it's Paul here. I just wanted to take a moment to say thank you for listening. I'm genuinely grateful to have you with us. If something you've heard today has resonated with you, I'd love to ask you a small favour. Think of one person in your life who might need to hear this conversation right now, then send it to them. One message, one share, You never know how much it could mean to someone who's struggling. And if you're enjoying This Is Powerful, follow the podcast and leave a rating or review. It really, really helps more people to discover these conversations. Now back to my conversation with Matt. It's so lovely to see you and sober, clear-minded. And like, you're clearly a strong guy and understand what you do and smart. How did the drinking really affect you towards the end?
I mean, the drinking became quite a problem when I would use, I would drink on my own. That's when it became like a problem. Like, I'd go out. It was mainly drugs. It was mainly cocaine. That was like when I got introduced to that when I was like 21, 22.
That was my thing, yeah.
Yeah. And it was like, wow, what the fuck is this? Like, it was just like incredible. And it made me feel, for someone who doesn't, I lack a lot of confidence, even to this day. Like, I'm not the most confident of people.
You'd never know.
No, but I'm not. Like, to the point where I have to walk with a bag, or I find it easier to walk with a jacket because it's got my hands, and for some reason if my hands are away or I'm holding something, it takes my mind off things. Like, it's hard to explain. Like, even like walking past people, I have this like thing that I think people are judging me or they're looking at me. Like, I can't even walk, but I find it hard walking to past oncoming traffic. Mm. Especially if there's like people are at standstill, because in my head I'm like, they're obviously saying something, or they're saying I look like a fucking idiot, or they're. So I think drink and drugs shut that off, and it became a coping mechanism for that. But also, like I've always said, it was like a medicine, but it was a medicine that I knew what I was going to get out of it. Mm. And then it became more than a medicine, it became my friend, because it wasn't going to answer me back, but it was going to fix all the issues that I had at that time. And yeah, it just became something that I looked forward to. Like, I'd get like really excited when I was going to go. Like, picking up was like the thing for me. Mm. Picking up was, it was just, even to this day, like, I don't think I've ever found anything that gives me the same.
It's placebo, interesting.
Placebo. I mean, like, sort of that.
It's a euphoric recall.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because that, I remember hearing that years ago about someone saying that, the thought of picking up the phone to the dealer, he had to run to the bathroom because his whole system would have just fucking fired up anyway, yeah, already before, yeah, he's even touched it.
Yeah.
And making a phone call, the anticipation was better sometimes than actually getting, yeah, the gear.
Yeah.
And it's incredible how the body and brain works. We were talking about that with a neuropsychopharmacologist about euphoric recall, how powerful it is.
Yeah.
Like I said to you before, for the first couple of years, I couldn't go into a hotel toilets.
Mm,
I just got this thing where I could see the toilet, the smell of the room, because I've been in them so much.
Yeah.
I found that difficult.
Well, I still do that thing now as well when I go into, like, I know it's a bit skanky, but like if I go into like a bathroom and I see stuff on the side and I do that and I'm like, oh, someone's been doing some gear, and they don't actually do anything, but I'm like, it's just weird because it's like you just put two and two together and I'm like, oh, this is a good toilet, this is a good bathroom, they've got a nice bit there that I could like rack a line up there and stuff like that. It is the association thing, isn't it? Like, all the time. Like, the toilet cubicle is, I'm going to do a line. But yeah, it was just weird. Like, that feeling that I had and the planning behind it. Like, it was to the point where if I was in the fucking army, I could, like, coordinate an invasion. Do you know what I mean? It's, yeah, very much like, I'm going to meet you here. I'm going to go and do this. And I've got to do this and do that. And yeah, it was just like, just a great feeling. And then when you add it, that first line was always a great one, but then the rest of it was also, it was just like catching up. Like, yeah, it didn't really do anything.
I think that's important to say for those people who are not there yet or are curious about stuff and hearing it. It's like, it's always like a big thing in the beginning, but then you're just trying to recreate that again.
Yeah.
And it just gets more of a creation as you go along.
Of course. Right? The feeling doesn't really change that much from the first one, but I would always make sure that I had two bags on me. So one what I would sort of try and do whilst I was out, and then my friends would be like, have you got any more on you? And I'd be like, no, I've got nothing anymore. And then I would look forward to going home and doing it on my own. That was like the epitome of a fucking great night. It was just like going home, sitting there watching Pornhub for like 4 to 5 hours, just going video after video after video, music on and just like racking lines up. Mm. And then all of a sudden it would just, oh fuck, I need to sober up because I've got work in the morning.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It was like very much
that
like...
click is the most dreaded thing.
It is.
Ever.
And then you start talking to yourself, you're like, what have I done? What the fuck? Oh, this is fucking wrong. And,
yeah.
But before that, I'm on the floor like with my phone torch trying to see if there's any crumbs on the floor for me to make another line. And it's licking the bag out and like finding keys that might have a little bit on it and like trying to dab that on. Yeah. And but it got to a point where I was, obviously this is when I had my own place or when I was like living at my parents, I was doing this. And I would do stuff where I'd like barricade the door. Because when I lived at my, I had to move back to my parents for a couple of years, but I would pop something in front of the door. So if my dad got up in the night, I could hear the door go so that it'd give me time to like put a pillow over the lines or like cover it up with a remote control or and try and act normal, not really make any eye contact with him. And
at least you knew who was coming through the door, because I used to do that when I lived in Miami and I was on the 12th floor. And I remember, it's really sad when I look back, but at the time I was like, I'm going to seal the blinds up in case anyone's looking.
Mm.
They had to be about 120 foot tall to look in the building.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I was just facing the sea. And I say, same stuff, totally exactly the same stuff. Yeah. I had a fire door in the kitchen and another door to the corridor. And I would towel both of them up, tape them all up, but no one was coming. At least you knew.
Yeah, exactly. That would be a strange guy. It's just my old man coming down his dressing gown, like, fuck off. I'm busy here. But yeah, when I was living in Kent and, you know, where I was living, sometimes the trains wouldn't run that late and that sort of thing. So I got into a habit of staying in hotels. Like, I'd start any grotty hotel that you can think of in Victoria Station or King's Cross, I've probably stayed in there. And it was just, I would just get fucked, start doing gear in the hotel room, then I'd just walk around the lobby aimlessly walking around, and then I'd go out for like the amount of cigarettes I'd go through like outside, and then not go to work the next day, just go straight home. And yeah, it was just the lying like about work and like not going in. And but I think with what I was doing, like on the grand scheme of things, it probably wasn't that severe in terms of like the industry that I worked in. There was always someone that had done like far worse than I had. Do you know what I mean? Like, so it never felt as if it was a problem. Boy, I was never going to get told off for it. But yeah, the doing it on my own was like a real... I did that for a number of years. It was very much... So it was quite just a bit of a shit place, really.
Mm.
And it was honestly just watching porn. Porn was like, yeah, my go-to.
I just think scrolling and stuff just keeps that brain obsessed.
Yeah.
It's like a hyper-focus, isn't it? And as soon as that stops... It's like dread.
Yeah.
When you said that about the industry, it was interesting because when I started, I remember the first day I went into my agency, there was a guy there, won't mention his name, doesn't work there anymore and hasn't done for a lot of years, who was going out sniffing in the toilet. And I was young. I was like 21. I knew what it was. I tried it a few times, but not a lot. And there was a girl I'd met who was absolutely stunning. I was like, my God, she's beautiful. I met her before the agency. We went in. And she went in the toilet with him. And then she kept going back and back. I'm thinking, what the fuck's going on? Like, what's going on? Like, she's completely being naive.
Of course.
And then we got the tube somewhere together. And from the time she went into the toilet, how nice she was, to the time she come out, was such a change.
Mm.
I was like, fucking hell.
Yeah.
I mean, it was probably a warning for me, but I carried on anyway. But back then, everyone was partying a lot.
Did you find that quite difficult, though, as a model? Did you? Because... I couldn't imagine doing drugs with my models, like, or being anywhere where there were drugs going on. Did you find that your relationship with your bookers was stronger because you all partied together? Or do you feel it was like more of like, I don't know, like just professional, on a professional level?
Yeah, that's a really good question.
You'd be like, oh, obviously you fucked up this casting because you're fucked and you sent me the wrong time.
I have never done drugs with an agent.
Yeah.
Any of my lot in London at all.
Yeah.
They was just drinkers. I never see them do anything. Mm. Drinking, yes, and like being absolutely fucking hammered and going in the morning. But I lived away a lot as well.
Mm.
So yeah, for some foreign agents, that's a really good question. I won't mention locations because...
No.
But yeah, there was a couple of agents. There was a couple of... there was a couple of agents that in LA that I was with that were hardcore.
Mm.
And I think at the time I felt like we was in the clique.
Yeah.
And there was a couple of times where 6 or 7 in the morning, I'd be there and I'd be thinking, I'd kind of sober up and thinking, what the fuck am I doing?
Yeah.
Like, I've got a massive job in like a couple of hours. And what the fuck is he doing? You know, like, there was a couple of times where I kind of sobered up and was a bit weird. And then there was a time I remember an agent had double booked me.
Yeah.
The commercial agent and the print agent had double booked me at the same time. And it was both incredibly big jobs. And I remember screaming at the agent, like, you fucked up, what have you done? And really had a go at them.
Mm.
And I've always regretted that because I've never done it before in my life. And I knew at that point something was wrong.
Yeah.
Because logically I could have said, fucking great, can we move one day to the other one?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Can we maybe do
who's
that?
Paying more?
Yeah. Yeah. Or who's going to be a longer term client? Yeah. Is this client going to be like a 5-year client? I'd never have done that. So the first time I ever really screamed at an agent, and to be honest, it's the only time. Mm. So I knew something was wrong at that point.
Mm.
But earlier on, like a lot of the European agencies would drive you around to clubs. Remember one in Spain, they'd be like feeding you pills in the car, like, yeah, let's go to this club, let's go to that. And it seemed like a period of what you described really well when you started to go out with the skinny jeans and the hair and stuff like that. So it seemed like that at first.
Mm.
But after, I think especially through the 90s and 2000s, things got a lot more corporate. And when we went from normal sort of analog film to digital, that changed a lot.
Mm.
But I felt initially that I was in the click.
Yeah.
But then I realised that was not the place to be.
Mm.
And there was one agent who I knew was really in trouble, and I tried to keep business and not merge it too much. But that was to find out as a young guy, because I was never advised in that way. So you kind of had to find your own feet.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a minefield, especially for models. I think, like we were saying earlier, in terms of being in awkward situations and you feel it's necessary for you to approach that because you think it's then going to lead on to further work, or, you know, the fact of going for drinks after a shoot with the clients and stuff, like, do you go or do you not go? And it could seem rude, do you go?
Like, no, that's a really big thing. So we used to do catalogue. Like you said, catalogue used to pay a lot more than shows as well back in the day. So we'd do catalogue, say, 40 days in a row, right? Wow. Say, south of France or whatever. And that was difficult because the client would be like, let's all go for dinner. And you'd go for dinner at like 8:30, been up since 5.
Mm.
Dinner would stop at 11. You'd all be 5 bottles of wine in and you'd have to get up and do it. And that, initially, I didn't have the boundaries to put in to say, you know what, I'd rather be fresh in the morning.
Of course.
Let's get good pictures done. We can have a laugh in the daytime.
Yeah.
Didn't know how to communicate that. So there was a few times where I looked at myself in pictures and thought, wow, I'm surprised they worked with you.
Mm.
But I know they were drinkers and they was choosing people as well that would come along and party with them.
Yeah, of course.
You know, so.
Yeah. That's like drinking in itself. It's, you surround yourself with people who it's like, it's fine to do that around with. Do you know what I mean? You're not going to go for drinks with people who don't, or my thing was, who'd go out for one drink. Like, is anyone who says to me, or should we go for a drink? I'd be like, no, we're going to go and get smashed. Like, I had no in between. So, like, anytime someone would want to go for something, I'm like, well, we're going in then. This is going to be it. And then we'll probably end up picking up. And, do you know what I mean? Exactly.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I suppose, with the modelling things, because I suppose when you're shooting abroad as well, like, it's like a cultural thing. Like, it can be deemed as rude if you don't then go and join them, or you don't have, do you know, or partake in certain activities. And I think sometimes that could be very difficult because you're on your own. Like, you are a representation of our agency, but like when you're away, you're that on your own. Like, you haven't got us holding your hand or like us to look after you.
Mm.
So, you know, and I think obviously in any industry, I think people take advantage of stuff like that. And I think,
it depends on the person. So if you're a good booker, like what you're saying, good agent, like what you're saying, it's different because you can explain stuff to young people and you can explain stuff how to be and say, you might be that there is a difficult time where you feel like you have to go for a late dinner.
Mm.
But if you explain it in a way where you're here to do the best job you can do, it's nothing personal, but I'm being paid to represent you guys. I want to make it really well. And there's ways around it that there you can is. Say.
Yeah,
I remember working, do you remember a girl called Patricia Velasquez? She was like this beautiful Latina supermodel, ended up being an actress. I remember shooting a commercial in Spain with her, and there was four like supermodels at the time, and it was a big thing, and everyone was hammered. And I was like, oh, I need to do the same. I need to belong. And she was like, nope. And as soon as 7 o'clock come along, she went, I need a car back to the hotel. And I watched, I was like, wow, how'd you do that? And she was the only one who was fresh up the next day, looked really well. No one complained. No one said anything. And that's another thing as well, is when you keep under the professional side of things, no one can really say anything.
No, and to be honest, mate, like that's kind of like how I like the way that I am now. I can cut things short. I can leave early. I can leave my team to be with the boys or like a client thing. Like when I'm done, I'm done. Do you know what I mean? Like, but I appreciate that more now. I think it looks far more professional me doing it. Obviously, yeah. I'm the director of the men's board. I want to portray that. I want people to know that I mean shit and I take this seriously and I'm not going to be fucking about and getting pissed up with the boys till 3 a.m. And I think, yeah, you do. I think it's a maturity thing, and obviously making those changes in my life to go sober has really helped. But yeah, I just feel like the older I'm getting, like I don't want to be seen as that fucking idiot. Do you know what I mean? Like,
did you before? Because I had a personality before where I worked with someone 3 years ago, a photographer, and we did a job in Dubai. And he's like, I heard him on the phone saying, I'd love Paul to do it. And I was like, oh yeah, I mean, I'll come and do it. It's great. And they had things you want to do on the job, like air ballooning, jet skiing and stuff. We go, I know Paul will do it. He does anything. He'll do that.
Yeah.
And I got a sinking feeling when he said that because I would have done before.
Yeah.
They're like, yeah, jump off this like 100-foot thing into the sea and make it look good.
Yeah,
and
I'd
be like, yeah, I'll do that. I'll be that guy. And for a while it was okay, but then I realized. But when I got that phone call last year, I was like, yeah, I'm older now. I won't be doing all of that.
Shit, though,
but I'll have some fun.
Yeah, of course. No, I mean, yeah, I suppose I have become far more introverted now. But then maybe that was because that's who I was at the start. But I was just it was all a big fucking mirage and cover up. Like I was created this caricature of this, like I said to you before we sat down, like of the Jekyll and Hyde kind of thing where I've just become a bit of a cunt, really, when I used to drink. Like, it was, I disrupted relationships. I became very selfish. I became very self-entitled. And you do. I think when you're drinking and you're doing drugs, like, you are selfish. You know, you'd have plans the next day, but that won't happen now because you've decided that you want to get another bag in at 4 a.m. Do you know what I mean? And I love the person that I've turned into now. Like, I've got that life that I wanted, I suppose, when I was drinking, but I wasn't ready to sort of like activate it at that time. Yeah. And yeah, I just feel like I've not completed it, but like I'm on my way to like getting it, if that makes sense. Like,
what do you have now that you didn't have?
I have an amazing partner. I have a really steady life, and people might see it as boring, but like, it's not boring. Like, it's great. The fact that me and her can sit indoors, but we like make each other laugh all the time, and she's happy and I'm happy, and I just feel so secure with her. And yeah, she's just, it makes me get really teary, but like she's very good for me. Like, and she's done a lot, and I'm so glad that she met me at my best.
Yeah.
Because I've been there on the floor and it ain't good. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've been through that shit. I've, you know, like I said, I'm still working on myself. I'm still finding myself, mate. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've not found me fully yet. And I love that. I love the fact that I'm still processing things and working things up for myself. But I'm doing it with someone that I love. And I'm in a situation that I can do it in.
Yeah.
It's not messy. Like, my mind's clear. Like, I'm not a messy person anymore. Like, I enjoy going to work. I enjoy the people that I work with. And I think I'm not saying that when you go sober, everything changes and the world becomes better and there's rainbows and fucking butterflies everywhere. It ain't like that. It's tough. Like, I still get the urges to do things.
Yeah.
But it does clear your mind out a lot easier, and it makes you foresee a lot better future. Do you know what I mean? Like, I know I can do things now. I know I've got the time and the space to do it within, because I don't have that, you know, impending doom every day and the anxiety and the come downs and, you know, walking along the street and thinking that someone driving past you is the drug dealer and they're going to kill you. Like, that's how I used to go in my head sometimes. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, just random shit like that. And yeah, just not knowing that you haven't upset anyone. I think that used to really get me, is you'd always dread that text from someone being like, I couldn't believe you was like that last night.
Yeah.
You was a fucking idiot yesterday. And going back to work on Monday and thinking you've upset people because you decided to have drinks in the office on Friday and you were being very outspoken, and just a bit clearer, do you know what I mean? And I love it. I love being an introvert. I've got my friends that I can count on one hand. I haven't got a big social group. I never have done. But it's a strong one. I've got my family. It just feels like it's all coming together. And obviously I said to you earlier, I want to have children and I want, you know, my kids might drink, they might take drugs, but like, I'd like to have the opinion and the ability to like guide them properly because I've done it.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. I'm never going to be that parent that goes, don't ever drink, don't ever do this, because I feel like I didn't have parents that tell me not to do it, but I still did it anyway.
Yeah.
So either way, they're going to fucking do it, whether you tell them not to or you know.
Did you go sober for a 12 step or did you just?
No, see,
stopped.
I just went cold turkey. I was with an ex and it was the only thing that used to cause any sort of mishaps and arguments and stuff was my drinking. So I decided it was my birthday. We'd been out the day before. And I just said to her, I was like, look, I'm just going to stop, because we got into a massive argument. Like, it was just like messy. I tried going to AA meetings, but I'm just not down with them. Yeah. I'm not down with the whole 12 steps thing. I think I found it very like holy and godly, and I'm an atheist, but I respect people that believe in something. I love learning about people's religions, but I don't have an interest and I don't have a belief in it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know, like maybe I just felt very much like I just wanted to do shit on my own and my own journey, and I didn't want to have to be in a room full of people and talk about my problems and feel as if I've got to get a coin to say that I've done this. And my own merit is my own life that I'm living, and like in my surroundings and the respect that I have from the people that I care about. I don't need a coin and random people to tell me that I've done well.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like I know when I'm coming home of a night and my missus isn't worried about me. I know when my parents aren't worried about where I am. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, fair play to anyone that does it. I've got no qualms or anything negative to say about it, but it just didn't work for me. And yeah, I just find that's part of the reason why I stopped doing the High Sobriety podcast, because I think I got to a point where I didn't want to keep talking about my past. But at the same time, it's like I was saying to you, like I'm a huge Manchester United supporter, but it doesn't mean I'm going to like every other Manchester United supporter. And when I was in the sober realm, it was great for what I did some festivals, did some talks. But you'd meet people and it was like living like life, and this is my thing, and that you've got to do this, and otherwise, you know, you're going to be fucking crucified. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah, getting preached, that's never
I'm just like, no, I'm not about that life. Like, I'll do it in my own pace, my own time. And, you know, obviously it works for people. People will talk about it, and some people have done very well out of it on social media. But yeah, I always feel like with some sobriety things, there's always like a thing that they're trying to sell, or there's always something, there's always like something about it.
Someone always makes something out of somewhere. I mean, I'm lucky because, you know, in my experience, I've avoided those, I avoid salesmen.
Yeah.
And I think everyone has their own personal journey.
Mm.
And, you know, whether people have therapy or they go down whatever route they go down, the proof is in the pudding in how you are, right?
Mm.
Final question. Anyone in the fashion industry that's struggling or doesn't know what to do, they think they have to drink because everyone else is drinking and stuff like that, what would you advise them to do?
Get out of the industry. Honestly, I don't think there's enough benefits for someone to stay amongst something which could lead to so many more negatives. Like if I had children, like I'd try and sway them away from being in the industry. Like if they wanted to like modeling, like I love it and what I do, but I just think if it's going to make you drink and it's going to turn you to like a darker place, then I'd really reframe and just think about what you want within this and whether it's going to give you enough to overcome that negativity. But if they would like to sort of stay put, then, you know, I would love to sort of be like their aid and give them advice and just try and sort of like, I don't know, you try and work out a schedule or a way in which they would work so they wouldn't be in or put in those certain situations that would then sort of have mishaps which could occur. And I think just giving someone time. You know, I check in some of my boys. They might not have anything on their charts and I might not need to talk to them, but I'll just be like, I'm just checking to see how you are. Do you know how powerful that can be? Yeah. Like someone checking in on you. When one of my friends does it to me, like it means so much. I might not have nothing to report back because, like I said, I live quite a quiet life and I'm not out on the go all the time, but just checking in on people. Like find, you know, your tribe. Find people that might be going through similar things or people that, you know, after a shoot, they might want to go for a run or they might want to go to the fucking cinema or they want to go for food or... It's like really trying to connect with people that you feel are going to be positive, you know, even on social media. Get rid of all the fucking idiots on your social media that are like, are you benefiting from watching their videos or is it just making you more angry?
Which
or,
is a profound question.
Yeah, yeah, it's just, I think it takes a lot of research and I think that's, it's very much on you for that. Like, you have to kind of find your feet and, but there are people that want to help. There's a lot of people out there that want to help and all it takes is just reaching out to someone or if you think someone's going through something, just check in. You know, make sure they're okay.
Matt, thank you very much.
No worries.
This is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation UK, which educates the public about addiction, recovery and a wealth of surrounding issues. We use lived experience and evidence-based science to support those in recovery and those struggling with addiction. To find out more about what we do, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com. You can also donate. Please donate. It really, really helps us to put this on for you guys. It will help us to break the stigma of addiction. It will also help us to educate more of the population and it will allow us to bring you more episodes. Thank you. See you next time.